Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Zachary Warzel. I represent the appellant Corey Bunk, also the plaintiff below. With me at council table is Marty Jackson, who tried the underlying case.
Morty.
I believe the briefs thoroughly set forth the relevant facts, so I'm not going to rehash those this morning in the interest of time. And I would like to reserve some time if I'm able to, approximately 5 minutes. This appeal involves one overarching and dispositive issue that I'd like to focus on, and that is whether it was prejudicial error when the trial court found without supporting evidence that Mr. Bunk committed a discovery violation with respect to military medical records and then imposed an instruction at trial that destroyed his credibility. There are a number of moving pieces to this issue, and I'd like to take them one by one, and I'll start with the trial court's factual findings. So first and foremost, the court found that there were additional medical records from the military file that existed that were not produced and that should have been produced. There simply was no factual support for this finding. As explained by Mr. Jackson in the briefing to the trial court and also at the pretrial conference, Mr. Bunk had submitted records requests to the military offices that he was directed to by the government itself. Those requests were proper. He received documents in response that he provided to Mr. Jackson in their entirety, and Mr. Jackson then provided those to the railroad in their entirety without withholding anything. Now, the railroad insisted to the court that it believed that additional medical records must exist based primarily in the briefing on Mr. Bunk's testimony in the 2012 deposition, where he testified about having 8 years prior to that in 2004 reviewed his military file when he mustered out of the Army. And he testified at that time that he recalled that the file he reviewed was approximately 2 to 3 inches thick. This, of course, is not evidence that additional records existed that were not produced in response to the records requests that were submitted to the government.
No, was there not evidence that he had injuries in Iraq?
Your Honor, I don't believe there was evidence of that. It's undisputed that Mr. Bunk, I take that back. There was a record that had to do with treatment of a right ankle injury while he was in the military. I don't personally know whether or not that happened in Iraq or not.
Okay.
But that was wholly irrelevant to this case. And by the way, that document, which was provided just prior to the pretrial conference, that was not a document that was produced by the government itself in response to the records requests that were submitted. Those were documents that Mr. Bunk located in his personal files that he had compiled while he was actually serving in the military.
Okay.
So that's an important distinction. But other than that, yes, it was undisputed that he engaged in combat, hand-to-hand combat while he was in Iraq. He was a pathfinder in the Army. He was out there kicking down doors. He fought with people. He was shot in the chest. It hit his Kevlar. He didn't suffer any injuries as a result of that. That was one of the reasons that the railroad suspected there was additional medical records. He was treated for that. I shouldn't say treated. He was examined for that by a field medic out in the field, and he was released to return to combat immediately. It's not like there was a doctor out there dictating notes to have a secretary transcribe them later on. We don't believe there is any record of any of that. And there certainly hasn't been any produced in this case by the government or anybody else. And it's important to note, too, that a medical release was actually provided to the railroad in conjunction with the pretrial conference. This was after the court initially found that he thought there was a discovery violation. Mr. Jackson at that point felt it important that, for the railroad to confirm for itself that there weren't additional records. It's my understanding the railroad did send that release out and received records in response, but importantly, nothing was ever provided in addition to what had already been provided to the trial court or any attempt made by the railroad to supplement the record in this appeal. So I think that's an important fact to keep in mind. So beyond just the factual finding that the court made about the existence of the record, it made three other factual findings as well. Number one was that the records were relevant. Obviously, that doesn't make any sense because you can't find that something's relevant that doesn't exist. The second one, the second finding that we take issue with is that the railroad was somehow prejudiced by this. Again, same reasoning. You can't be prejudiced by the non-production of documents that don't exist. Now, beyond...
So, I'm sorry, you keep saying that the records don't exist. I understand that that's your belief, but can you identify in the a place in the record where the trial court was told that the record doesn't exist as opposed to it wasn't given to us or we've given you everything that the client gave me?
Your Honor, I can't... I don't specifically recall Mr. Jackson ever using those exact words, these records don't exist. But I think it was made crystal clear that there were no additional records that Mr. Jackson or Mr. Bunk were aware of that had not already been provided to the railroad. So I think by logical inference, it can be concluded that there were no additional records. You have to be able to rely on the government or whoever it is that you're seeking records from to provide the records. If they don't provide certain records, and that does happen, I acknowledge that, happens in my practice when I seek medical records from doctors. You can send them a release that says, please give me your entire file, including medical records, intake sheets, et cetera, et cetera. They give you a file, and then lo and behold, you end up in a records deposition or a deposition to the doctor 3 months later, and you find out that the office, for some reason, did not provide you with 100 pages of documents that were on the other side of the file. And so, there's never an explanation for why that happens. But so, again, there is no indication in this case that that happened with the government.
So as I understand it, Mr. Bunk, though, was discharged for the disability.
You know what, Your Honor? I'm not 100% sure that that's the case. Okay. If you'd like me to check with...
Nope.
Mr. Jackson's nodding his head no. So
nope.
My understanding is that that is not why he discharged.
Okay.
I think he just left after his tour of duty in Iraq, and it was not until he injured his back at the railroad that he had any kind of disability or limitations whatsoever.
Sure. Counsel, wasn't the court concerned about whether counsel and perhaps Mr. Bunk himself had done enough to push the government for records that the court seemed to think would exist?
I think there may have been a suggestion of that. I don't think it's clear what the court exactly was thinking the discovery violation was. What I was about to get to in my argument, I think, is responsive to your question. Beyond these factual findings that I've been talking about, it seems to me from reviewing the pretrial conference record that the court really based this finding of a discovery violation on its feeling that there is a rule of law out there that I don't believe exists. And that rule is that if you as a plaintiff's attorney refuse to give a defendant a blanket medical release to obtain all of your client's records, that you assume a gatekeeper function is the words of the court. And when you assume that function, you have an affirmative duty as an attorney to go out and conduct an independent investigation, obtain all the records yourself. And I think by implication, that extends also not just to records, but to any factual evidence in the case.
Well, that's going farther than the court went. You guys declined to give the blanket release. So why isn't the court perfectly within its rights to say, okay, if you won't give the blanket release, then it's on you. Okay, you are responsible for getting all this information. What's wrong with that?
And Your Honor, I don't disagree with that conclusion. What I disagree with is the court's implication that you have a duty as the attorney to personally go out and get these documents. What Mr. Jackson did in this case, I find to be completely appropriate.
Well, this is not about that. But the attorney represents the client. The attorney, I guess I'm a little bit troubled by your attempt to wave away this obligation to obtain documents responsive to discovery. If it's not counsel's responsibility, whose is it?
What I believe happened in this case, and the record reflects, is that Mr. Bunk made the appropriate medical record requests. I don't think it's a material fact. It's not a material difference whether Mr. Jackson goes out and sends this release that Mr. Bunk said, or whether it's Mr. Bunk that sends it. The bottom line in this case is that the appropriate requests were made and documents were received in response to that request, which were then provided in their entirety to the railroad. So I don't.
But given the deposition testimony, can't the court infer that Mr. Bunk was withholding documents?
I don't.
He said, I reviewed a file that was 3 inches thick. The railroad says, we've got a file that's a half inch thick. And the clear implication there is that 2.5 inches worth of file has not been produced, and that Mr. Bunk is aware of those 2.5 inches, wherever they are, he knows they exist.
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that that deposition testimony, at best, was an estimate of a foggy memory that Mr. Bunk had from 8 years prior.
Well, that's one argument, but is that, why is the court in its discretion required to accept that?
Well, I think if the court is going to impose something as onerous as an instruction that it gave in this case, it better be sure that there actually has been a withholding of documents, not simply based on a speculative conclusion that's based on sketchy deposition testimony of a recollection that's 8 years old.
What lesser sanction are you proposing the court should have given?
I don't think there should have been a sanction because there was never a discovery violation. But beyond that, I think at the very most, the court should have ordered the continuance that was requested not only by BNSF, which was then renewed by Mr. Jackson during the pretrial conference. So I don't think that's technically a sanction, but it would have allowed the court to satisfy itself that there had not been a discovery violation, because it would have provided enough time for the railroad, I guess, to go out and get its own copy of the file, which I believe was done in this case. I have to reiterate that. And there were no additional records provided to the court. It would have also provided, if theoretically there were some type of discovery violation, if there were additional records that hadn't been provided, the railroad would have had an opportunity to actually get those records, and it would have cured whatever prejudice the railroad was claiming. But instead, what happened here is the court gave this adverse credibility instruction that went to all issues in the case, which effectively destroyed Mr. Bunk's ability to put on a circumstantial evidence case, which, as the briefs point out, is a very important aspect of FILA jurisprudence, and that it's a much lower burden of negligence in a FILA case. And I see that I'm below my 5 minute limit, so I'd like to reserve the rest of my time if there's no other questions.
Good morning. Fred Martinez for the record, registration number 16954. Good morning, counsel. This case is about harmless error and also whether the issues that are raised are moot. The primary reason for that is because the jury believed the following. The jury believed that the track inspector who inspected the switch 2 days before found no problems with the switch. They believed the plaintiff's original statement that he did not believe that the switch was defective in any manner. They believed his report that said there was no problems with the switch, that it was not defective, that he did not sustain an injury associated with the switch. The jury also believed his coworkers, who said that the plaintiff never informed him of any problems with the switch.
Mr. Martinez, what we know is they found no negligence. Do we know that they believed all of that?
And that, yes. Because there's a finding of no negligence, the issue that is primarily being argued today is moot, harmless, and I will address that specifically. The reason why is the issue that is being discussed here is a discovery violation about the plaintiff's military medical records, which may have shown the evidence of degenerative disc disease, prior injuries to his lumbar spine, which was the exact same injury associated with the claims in this case. That goes toward the issue of damages. What is the nature and extent of his injury? Did it pre-exist? Was it aggravated? Was there some sort of causation issue associated with his physical condition? The jury, when they said there is no negligence, never had to answer the question about, one, damages, two, apportionment, never had to consider the issue of degenerative disc disease at all. So therefore, that's my argument in terms of why it is either moot or harmless, but I will get into the substance of it as well.
But don't we have the difficulty that Mr. Bunk is raising that says the jury was instructed essentially, don't believe my testimony. And would that not have affected their conclusions regarding whether he was injured at that time and place?
Injured in terms of condition to his back. And if the jury found that there was negligence, then they would also have to make a decision about what are his damages. What was caused as a result of this switch? What preexisted? What was aggravated? To what extent are his disabilities that existed before and after the operation of the switch? The special verdict form in this case was very clear. They never had to answer those questions. The argument that is actually being raised is kind of like an old parable of hiding the ball. Plaintiff counsel says, I once had a ball. That ball is no longer here. I'm not going to tell you how to get access to it, but it's up to you to tell us the color of that ball. That's exactly what happened here. That's what the trial judge saw. Let me tell you why. This case had 10 months to complete discovery. The trial court found that for 8 months, a discovery violation had occurred. Medical records had come in a piecemeal fashion. Trial counsel and the medical testimony conceded that the plaintiff had degenerative disc disease in his lumbar spine. So we're told that this ball does in fact exist, and we're told that he was in the military, and we're told that he had a sprained ankle and was shot in the chest and fought hand-to-hand combat. But the medical records that come in do not show physical examinations, the conclusions of the doctors, whether he was treated, and what is the nature and extent of the degenerative disc disease. When did it exist? Was it diagnosed? How far did it progress or not? What color is that ball? And now they complain that, well, that we gave you a release. Plaintiff's counsel gave the defense a release in order to obtain those records. Well, you know, that release was given 4 days prior to the jury trial. Thursday before the Monday jury trial. I don't know of any lawyer with all the electronics or internet access in the world is going to be able to get military medical records within those 4 days. What color is that ball? To this date, we don't know. So, what we do know is that the court found that this discovery violation had occurred for 8 months. And what is missing through this whole argument is what the Supreme Court of Colorado has said and over and over and over again in the Aloy case, Aloy versus Union Pacific Railroad. That case stands for the proposition that the trial court is afforded great discretion in order to make a determination. Has there been a discovery violation? If so, what is the appropriate sanction? It is irrelevant about the intent of a counsel or the client or whether or not this evidence was destroyed maliciously, intentionally, or negligently. What is important is the fact that it was, in fact, destroyed or is missing. And so that the Aloy case stands for the proposition of how do you cure or how do you remedy this prejudice upon the defendant?
And the evidence that it existed other than his reference to a 3-inch file is what?
The concession by his physicians and counsel, he had degenerative disc disease. The fact that we know that there was some injury in Iraq, there were no physical examination documents within the military medical records for us to confirm or corroborate the nature and extent of it.
There was no final
discharge, physical
evaluation
from a physician. Now, he did receive, I believe, an honorable discharge, but in terms of a discharge from a physician that says, there would be
a discharge physical with her.
And there was
no evidence presented of a discharge physical.
We did not receive that. We did not receive that. And so what Aloy says is that an adverse inference instruction can, in fact, be given. And if you look at the instruction in Aloy, it was actually much more significant than the one that was given here. Because they said in Aloy that because evidence is missing, you can infer that that evidence had a negative impact upon the plaintiff's, in that case, the railroad's case in chief. And in this case, the trial court said the missing documents, the discovery violation, jurors, you can evaluate that when you evaluate the plaintiff's credibility. Now, the reason why I keep referring to this being a moot or harmless error issue is because the only time that that curative instruction was read, when plaintiff's counsel said in the opening statement or through his physician or the plaintiff himself, the plaintiff has a pristine back. Good perfect health. I have no prior injuries. Well, that's the rock and hard place kind of argument.
What evidence did the plaintiff put on to support negligence?
His own testimony.
Well, if it's his own testimony and the juror, this instruction erodes his credibility, how does that not drift into the negligence aspect? I guess I'm just not understanding the harmless error argument.
Okay, you're saying that the adverse inference instruction involving credibility could have bled over?
Yes.
Potentially it could have. However, when you look at when the instruction was read, it was always contemporaneous when they would put that condition of his pristine get back being an asserted fact.
Well, I understand it was contemporaneous to certain evidence, but were they limited to applying it to the evidence that it was read in a contemporaneous fashion?
The court said for the limited purpose, you can consider this discovery violation, and it was read at that same time. Now, did the trial court say you can only consider it as it relates to his back? No, the trial court did not say that. It said it only at the time that this evidence was admitted, and then the court tried to soften it at that point. When you ask about the questions of negligence and what was the evidence of negligence, well, that's where I started off my argument, and that is I quoted very, I don't normally do this in a brief, but I quoted the plaintiff's exact testimony that he never complained about the switch, it operated normally, that it was not defective the first time nor the second time, that he never told his co-workers about it being inoperable or that the switch was hard to throw. He never told his supervisors, dispatch. He never placed a red tag, meaning that it is out of service or that there's a defect, to warn others associated with it. And that the personal injury report reflected in his own handwriting with his own statements that there were no defects associated with it, and that he didn't find it to be difficult to operate at all. He, quote, simply checked the box saying that nothing was wrong with the equipment. So when you, Your Honor, ask the question, what evidence is there of negligence? I think it's all in our favor. And that's where the jury believed the plaintiff to say that, yes, there is no negligence associated with this. Now, a couple of other things, because that we were focusing solely on the non-disclosure of certain medical records, but there's a variety of other evidentiary issues that have been raised as well that I'll address briefly. They've raised four other issues. They talked about a safety briefing that was erroneously excluded. They talked about the plaintiff's Facebook comment about winning the BNSF lottery. They talked about surveillance of the plaintiff being excluded as well. Those three issues, the safety briefing, Facebook, and surveillance, taking those one at a time, the safety briefing had to deal with the trial court's inherent decision to make a balancing decision about whether the evidence was more probative than not, and did it actually contain inflammatory material. And I think what the plaintiff counsel is arguing is that their trial court exercised an abuse of discretion when it weighed that evidence. The safety briefing talked about, well, first of all, it was generated after the fact. It talked about other types of injuries not related to this case. It talked about statistical information about cumulative or repetitive stress type of injuries. And the trial court looked at that document and said, it's not relevant. It is subsequent in time, and it also said it's excluded as a subsequent remedial measure. So consequently, the trial court excluded that. But what is that evidence of? What are these other three topics that I raised evidence of? The safety briefing, the Facebook surveillance, all deal with issues after the fact that the jury never had to answer on its special verdict form. The safety briefing, if it had come in, as plaintiff's counsel says, it should have, talked about pushing versus pulling. How did the plaintiff potentially, how was he instructed to operate the switch? Was it to push or to pull? Well, if he was instructed to push rather than pull or vice versa, all that that evidence goes toward is the issue of the plaintiff's contributory negligence or causation. But here, the jury found that there was no negligence on behalf of the BNSF. So that question, again, is moot, irrelevant. It wasn't necessary for the jury to make that kind of decision. When the plaintiff says, I'm going to win the BNSF lottery, well, first of all, he made that statement, no one else. He made a statement to the supervisor or to a BNSF official when he was interviewed about, well, I'll retire when I win the lottery, referring to the FELA, the Federal Employers Liability Act. That goes toward the issue of the plaintiff's failure to mitigate. What is his proper motivation? What is his bias? What is his intent from here on out when he wants to win the lottery? Again, that goes, and it was a highly contested issue during the course of the jury trial. Did the plaintiff fail to mitigate his damages? Did he have the proper motivation? Was he simply sitting back waiting for that lottery to actually come to fruition?
Well, Mr. Martinez, that particular statement seems to me to be of a nature that it would affect Mr. Bunk's credibility in a general way. I've hit the railroad lottery. Don't you agree? So it could relate to his testimony concerning negligence, not merely damages, and therefore wouldn't be moot.
And if it is a question regarding credibility, the best person to make that decision are the jurors who actually decided that fact.
But you're not contending that particular piece of evidence is of a type that relates only to damages or only to comparative negligence?
If you look at the context in terms of when that testimony came out, what was surrounding that testimony, it was all in relationship to when the plaintiff stopped working, had failed to obtain any type of alternative employment, failed to seek alternative employment, and had not gained any alternative employment. That's when that cross-examination came out. That's when the comments about winning the lottery came out. It was also used during the cross-examination of his vocational rehabilitation counselor, who talked about the motivation of an injured person in terms of what is a proper motivation and how can they best help that person when they're attempting to return to work. Does it involve a general question of credibility? Yes. In the specific context of this case, it was always dealing with the issue of, do you have the proper motivation to mitigate your damages?
But we don't have an instruction telling the jury to limit that testimony to those purposes. How can we assume that a jury would do that?
Can you imagine an instruction every time that there is a trial court, the burden it would put on a trial court to instruct the jury that this piece of cross-examination is only going toward this specific fact?
No, I can't. But I also can't imagine jurors taking this piece of evidence and disregarding it for every purpose except mitigation of damages. I can't imagine that either.
And that is exactly why we give deference to the trial court to make that kind of balancing determination as to what is the breadth of the evidence that I have seen before me. Is it admissible? Is a curative instruction warranted at this point? Or should there be a limited instruction? And for those reasons, I think that we should give deference not only to the factual finder, but to the trial court as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. Mr. Warzel, you have additional time.
Thank you. I'd like to just address a quick couple of points. Mr. Martinez was talking about harmless error with respect to this instruction issue. And I want to reiterate, and Judge Carparelli, you were absolutely right when you raised this. We don't know what effect this instruction had on the outcome of this case. The instruction clearly is not limited to the issue of damages or to any other issue in the case. It's specifically directed at, it's pointing the laser beam at Mr. Bunk's credibility as a witness. Under FELA, your credibility is paramount when you're putting on a circumstantial evidence case, which is essentially what we had here. As pointed out, most of the evidence on negligence, not all of it, but most of it did come from Mr. Bunk directly. So when the jury is told repeatedly by the judge that they can consider his violation of discovery obligations and the prejudice to the railroad, when they're considering his credibility as a witness, they're essentially being told repeatedly that they're to look on anything that he says or that his lawyer puts on at trial with suspicion, if not outright disbelief. And when Mr. Bunk tried to rehabilitate that by taking it on head on in his direct testimony, when he testified that he had actually obtained these documents and given them in their entirety to Mr. Jackson, the jury has to be presumed to have looked on that as an act of perjury, because they have to be presumed to have followed the court's instructions, which told them to look on anything he says with suspicion. And here he is telling them that he actually didn't do what the court just instructed them as a matter of law that he did do.
Was there a post-injury inspection of the switch?
There was a post-injury inspection performed by the railroad. It was a team of three persons. One of those people, McDonald, thank you, was called as the first witness in Mr. Bunk's case. And he actually provided some of the evidence that supported a negligence finding. And I have to point out here that there was a directed verdict. A motion for directed verdict that was made by the railroad at halftime, and the court denied that. There was sufficient evidence to support a claim of negligence going to the jury in this case. It's not, as Mr. Martinez was insinuating, that the only evidence in this case favored a finding of no negligence. It wouldn't have gone to a jury if that were the case. I only have 10 seconds here, so I just want to point out that Mr. Martinez raised the Alloy case as somehow helpful to their side. I totally disagree. That case actually supports where we're coming from. It found a adverse inference instruction that was far less onerous than what was imposed on Mr. Bunk here, and it was done in the context of undisputed evidence that the railroad in that case had destroyed a number of very important documents that they admitted to doing. In this case, we had absolutely no evidence that any documents actually existed that were withheld. And instead of tendering an Alloy type instruction, which is what BNSF actually asked the court to do after he denied their continuance, he rejected that and went further and said, I'm going to impose this adverse credibility instruction that went to all issues in the case, not just to the allegedly missing documents. I think that was highly prejudicial, and I think Alloy actually very strongly supports the position that we're coming from in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your arguments, counsel. This case is now accepted as submitted, and we will issue an opinion in due course. That completes.